This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
The following program uses what are sometimes called four-letter words, though in this case they're actually eight letters and perhaps a seven-letter gerund. It's Friday, March 11th, 2022. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. For 2 weeks, Australia has experienced massive flooding. 22 people have died. In the New South Wales town of Doon, they've received a decidedly undelightful deluge. 1 meter of rain in 48 hours. I'll do the math. It's the same as the annual average precipitation that Washington, D.C. gets. And the government has declared a state of emergency. That interests me because state of emergency powers were only granted to the federal government in the wake of the awful brush fires of a couple years back. But of course, in between those two weather events was another natural disaster, the pandemic. Australia was an interesting case. It went through their version of the national crisis like no other country, no free society on earth, asked its citizens to do exactly what Australia did, and no large country escaped the ravages of COVID to the extent that Australia did either. Now, if you read the conservative press here, and to some extent there, these strict COVID lockdowns threatened to tear Australian society apart. Yet everything I've read indicates that Australians are coming together in this new national emergency. So I wanted to get an assessment, an accurate assessment from a trusted source. What do Australians really think of how their government handled COVID? I talked to Josh Zepps, broadcaster with the ABC, the Australian Broadcast Company, and a podcast host. He told me this.
If you look at polling, Australians are extremely proud of what Australia has achieved. In terms of the mortality as a proportion of the population, I think the mortality is about 97% less than the United States and the UK were. The ability to sort of, you know, continue to flatten the curve and continue to use aggressive contact tracing and sort of isolation to nip in the bud any eruptions of coronavirus. Because I think there's a misconception maybe overseas in some places that Australia was completely quarantined and the virus never got in. It was quarantined and you had to spend 2 weeks in a quarantine hotel up until the 1st of November last year if you wanted to come into the country. But nonetheless, it escaped from the quarantine hotels a number of times, and there were breakouts all over the place. And various states handled that with various degrees of quote-unquote rampant authoritarianism, as the alt-right American keyboard warriors might call it. In certain states, so I think it's important to understand that this was very, very, very much a state-by-state thing. Western Australia, which is basically the entire western half of the continent, is still closed, even to other Australians. You can't go in, and if you do go in, then you will be incarcerated in a quarantine hotel, and that is only going to be phased out in coming months. Victoria, which is the state where Melbourne is, took a very strong police-heavy attitude, imposing nightly curfews and so on for very long lockdowns. I think the longest lockdown in the world. But perhaps I'm somewhat, and the weird thing is, I was going to say perhaps I'm somewhat biased because I'm from Sydney, which is the largest city in the most populous state, which took a more, what Americans might think of as a more hands-off-y kind of attitude, a little bit, just 1% towards the Florida-Texas model versus the New York-California model. But I don't think that that I am biased, because opinion polls in Victoria and Western Australia are also wildly supportive of those governments. Now, you could say that people have a kind of a Stockholm syndrome and that they don't know what they don't know, but the reality is, in places where there's never been a major COVID outbreak like Western Australia, they've basically been living as if the pandemic never happened. They haven't had hospitalizations to speak of. They haven't had masking to speak of. They haven't had school closures to speak of. And so the Australian population is generally like, yeah, you're going to, at the very, very, very fringes, there are going to be cases in which people who are agitating for an extremely libertarian vision of individual rights find themselves in situations where the police are kind of forced to enforce silly rules or arbitrary rules or rules that seem capricious. That's always going to be the case with police interactions with the public, and it's certainly going to be the case during public health emergencies where dire laws need to be enacted for a short-term period. But, you know, now that we wander out of it and international tourists are allowed back in Australia now, we can travel, we can come back. Well, you have to be vaccinated to come into the country, but that's the sort of the last barrier to fall. The sense in Australia is good on us. We did a good job.
Thank you, Joshua Zepps, on the show today. It's not a question of if we're going to get hit by a Russian cyber attack. It's a question of how hard will it be when we get hit again. But first, columns of tanks approaching Kiev began to disperse, which is a troubling sign. It means they're surrounding the capital of Ukraine. Some humanitarian corridors in that country are being honored, and so far over 2 million refugees have emerged from the country. But there was one, at least one corridor in Mariupol that collapsed, according to Volodymyr Zelensky, and Russians attacked innocent Ukrainians. 48 schools have been destroyed in Kharkiv, its mayor said. The city is receiving relentless bombardment. That is some of the updates. Here now the conversation that I will have with the University of Chicago's Paul Post on where we stand on this horrible conflict.
Podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Paul Post is a professor at the University of Chicago, the Department of Political Science. He studies international relations. He writes about, well, arguing about alliances and organizing democracy and the economics of war. And we should also mention he's the assistant director of the Chicago Project on Security and Threats, which is C Post, but it's a different kind of post. That's just a coincidence because his surname is P-O-A-S-T. You get it. Professor Post, thanks for coming on The Gist.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
I was listening to you on a podcast about a week ago, and you characterized where the Ukrainian war was as something like the end of the beginning. It's been a week. The main headlines haven't changed much. Russia still trying to take Kyiv, Russia having obtained one key Ukrainian city. Are we still in that phase, the end of the beginning?
I think we're getting into the middle phase now. And the question is, how long is this going to last? And based on what I'm seeing, from my perspective, we're heading towards the quagmire scenario, right? This is the scenario where Russia is essentially bogged down in Ukraine. There's slow progress made on either side. I mean, that's been the nature of the reports that I've been seeing is, well, it seems like a little bit of progress here, maybe a little bit of progress by Ukrainian forces. But when you have a military like Russia's, which at least based on raw numbers should overpower the Ukrainian forces. When you have a military of that size, that's also willing to use more ruthless measures, which is something that we're now starting to see Russia do. And you combine that with a side that they're fighting that is receiving a lot of international assistance, which has absolutely been the case in terms of the Ukrainian forces. That's a recipe for a protracted conflict. And so I think that we are now into the middle. Last week, we were at the end of the beginning. We are now getting into the middle phase of this. And the question is, how long is that going to last?
So when we think of quagmire, it seems bad for the aggressor. Bogged down is a phrase that quagmire connotes, but it's also really bad for those being occupied, isn't it?
It is. This would be horrendous for Ukraine. Now, the thing to keep in mind, though, is that the nature of the conflict could be such that some areas of Ukraine, you could probably go about your daily life and not notice that there's a war going on. And then there's going to be other areas where the cities are being decimated, there's active fighting. And that's not unusual for a lot of conflicts, especially once they start to morph into this civil war, almost insurgency type flavor. This is similar to like what we observed in Iraq or what could have been observed in Afghanistan. But if we want to use Iraq and Afghanistan as models, then it goes to your point that having an ongoing protracted conflict in those countries was not beneficial to those countries in any means. And so you're exactly right to say that on the one hand, a protracted conflict would be devastating to the Russian military, but even more so, it's going to be devastating to the Ukrainians, their economy, their country, their livelihoods.
Well, quagmire to the United States means one thing, and the United States conducts its military affairs with a great distaste for incurring casualties to its own side, and also certainly not perfect care in minimizing civilian casualties on the other side. Yeah, I know people listening to this will say, how could you even say that? I'm just comparing it to other armies that occupy. The United States actually does have procedures to try to minimize that. So it means one thing to the United States, but it means a different thing to Russia, I believe, if you look at their history and the history of their occupations under Putin. How much will that play into what a quagmire would mean in this conflict?
So I think a good way to conceptualize this, if you will, is to think about how the beginning of the conflict followed what I would call a Crimea model. And in this case, this is in reference to what Russia did in 2014 with the Crimean Peninsula, where they quickly sent in their forces, gained control of the territory, nary a shot was fired. It was just like, hey, we're here. That's why we call it a fait accompli. It's just like, oh, we're here. And before you can even have a chance to react, we've already taken control. My sense is that that was their hope for this initial invasion, that they were going to be able to accomplish that same thing, but at scale for the entire country of Ukraine. Now, you can question whether that was a sensible thing to assume, but that's my impression of what they went in with. And as they started to get bogged down and as the international community turned to supporting Ukraine, you are now starting to see where they are shifting to what you could call a Chechnya model or a Syria model. And that is in reference to what you're referring to, which is this is an escalation of the lethality of the fighting. This is a more ruthless form of fighting. This is a greater willingness to target civilians, to target medical centers. And this is a devastating form of warfare that even if their military is getting bogged down, and even if they're getting short of resources, they can still do tremendous harm and tremendous damage. And you're exactly right that the Russian military, by looking at their long history, but even their more recent history over, say, the past 10 to 20 years, has shown a willingness to engage in this type of warfare.
So do you think that Putin, who certainly hoped for the Crimea type takeover without incurring losses, do you think if you had told him, actually, that's not going to happen, it'll have to be a quagmire, do you think he would have signed up for that?
I think he would have signed up for it. But I think if you could have convinced him that it was going to be a protracted conflict that was going to require high levels of lethality, you would have seen a very different opening of the campaign. You would have seen a higher use of air power at the beginning. You may have even just seen flat out bombardment of cities at the beginning, bombing of cities, because they would have said, well, we're going to have to be ruthless. We might as well go all in with the ruthlessness. I mean, to give you another example of how it seemed like they thought they could get away with a lower cost invasion was, number one, they were using the roads. They were just coming right through the roads. It's like, hey, because that's what they did in Crimea. Number two, and this surprised a lot of people who say have war gamed this over the years, they didn't use like a cyber attack to say knock out the electricity, right? That just wasn't done. And this would have been something that you would expect them to do maybe in conjunction with then starting to bomb, right? And so that's my sense, is that if you could have convinced Putin that this is going to be hard, this is going to be difficult, I don't think it would have deterred him, but I think he would have encouraged a different strategy at the beginning.
Yes, I'm pretty convinced of that too. I just think that so often we have looked at Putin through Western eyes and maybe through hopeful eyes or through the eyes of a rational person expecting to see what we've normally seen from Putin, which is rationality, and gotten it wrong. And I wonder if in this case we think of this will be a quagmire. They will be, verb, bogged down in quagmire. But to Putin, the man actually calling the shots, it's more like committed to quagmire.
I think committed to quagmire is a way of putting it. And to me, what really gives validity to this idea that he would have been committed to this is just his own words, right? If you look at what he was saying in the lead up to this invasion, he is committed to conquering Ukraine, if not flat out conquering it, at least having it be a part of Russia's sphere of influence. But he's making references to the Russian Empire, to the Soviet Union. He's on record of saying that the collapse of the Soviet Union is the greatest calamity of the 20th century. So he is very much committed to this idea of pursuing what he views as Russian interest in the near abroad. And I think in that sense, he would have been committed to being involved in a protracted conflict so long as it had the objective of increasing their influence over Ukraine.
What might shake that commitment?
That's a tough question because I am also having difficulty knowing what could be an off-ramp for Putin, right? This is something that we've been witnessing. These peace talks have been happening. I think just the third round of peace talks were held. And there's even been discussions about a, quote, moderation of the Russian demands, right? Which, to keep in mind, to put that in context, moderation means going from we want to conquer the entire country and annex it into Russia to something lower than that. Well, there's a lot that can go lower than that that's still going to be potentially unacceptable to the Ukrainians. And I think that's the case.
Right, right. It could be, for instance, lower than that is, okay, we'll take half of Ukraine. Lower than that is, okay, we'll take all of Ukraine acting as somewhat of a vassal state, you know, allowing us to influence them like we influenced Finland, or, you know, puppet government, which is more than that, but less than actual Russians in the presidency.
Absolutely. And indeed, the nature of the offer that I saw that was being reported was Russia would still have control of the eastern provinces. They would have Ukraine recognized, fully recognized that they had indeed annexed Crimea, that Russia would have had influence on who could be prime minister, that Ukraine would make a pledge to never join NATO. I mean, these are all things that are just complete violations of Ukrainian sovereignty. And I just can't see Zelensky, and nor could I even see Biden, if he was advising Zelensky, saying, yeah, should go along with that. Because I think the fear would be that that would encourage future behavior like this, that, hey, if you launch an invasion, you can still, everybody's so scared of your nukes, they will give you a big chunk of what you want.
You had a big thread about why sanctions in this case probably won't work. It didn't surprise me before the sanctions were even fully imposed. I did a segment on the show about how sanctions almost never work. But I was surprised by how big the sanctions were. Did that affect your analysis?
It does affect my analysis in a couple ways, but not necessarily in the way of making it, me think that it'll work. It affects my analysis in two ways. First of all, yes, these sanctions are unprecedented in scale and scope. I mean, we even have Switzerland involved in these sanctions. And this is a country that has just always tried to avoid, you know, the epitome of the neutral country. And of course, when it comes to financial sanctions, Switzerland would also be an important player because of the, you know, idea of Swiss bank accounts and corrupt individuals keeping money there. So this has been huge in terms of the scope and the scale, but the two ways in which it's affected my thinking, and not in a way that makes me think that these are going to be effective, is number one, I'm very much concerned about these sanctions backing Putin into a corner, basically making him feel like he doesn't have any other options. His economy's already shot. That's not going to get any better. And indeed, could you imagine these sanctions being lifted and fully lifted with Putin still in office? I don't think so. So I think Putin's already kind of factored that in. He's like, well, I have nothing to lose now. And moreover, if you couple that with a quagmire in Ukraine, and then you start coupling this with more and more Western assistance, maybe even in the point of close to, if not actual direct involvement by NATO states in this conflict, you could see where Putin would feel like, I have nothing left to do. I have no other option but to perhaps lash out at a NATO ally to try to make this stop. So that is something that I'm very concerned about. That's number one.
Were there smarter ways to have constructed the sanctions then, do you think?
Well, I think this is a situation where in foreign policy, oftentimes you have nothing but bad options and you're just trying to pick the least bad option. And so I don't know if there would have been a better way. Maybe you could have started with just the targeted sanctions, not try to hammer the entire economy, right? Maybe that's one strategy to this, to truly say that this is about Putin. This is about his inner circle. This is not about the Russian people. The problem is that the Russian state is so intertwined with the other aspects of the Russian economy that that would be hard to fully disentangle. But I think what you started to see, and this is the second way in which I've updated on this, is given the scale of these sanctions, and now we're talking about actually blocking the oil, I'm having trouble seeing where these are going to be sustained. One of the things we know is that in international relations, cooperation is difficult. It's difficult to get a coalition together. And so keeping this scale of sanctions in place for a week, sure. 2 weeks, sure. 2 months, maybe. 6 months, you're going to have a lot of these countries starting to say, man, can we sustain this? Because remember, sanctions work by putting pain on yourself. And will these countries be willing to continue to endure that type of pain, given that this could become a protracted conflict with no clear endpoint? That's the other thing that I become very concerned about, which makes me even more skeptical that these could work.
Right. But on the other hand, the concern was that he'd be so backed into a corner by being punished by these sanctions. So under this scenario, that scenario is alleviated a little bit.
That is true. So if it does, and to be honest, I think Putin is betting on that. I think that you have kind of these two scenarios, neither of which is really a good scenario. The one is that they are able to keep this pain going, but that backs Putin into a corner. The other scenario is Putin knows that he can wait it out. He's like, they're going to eventually need my oil. They're eventually going to need the gas. They're eventually going to want to have access to these financial markets or, you know, bank funds, what have you. He just knows that he has time on his side, at least given his tolerance for this pain relative to the tolerance that the international community would have for this economic pain.
In the past, you know, you talk about Putin being backed into a corner, and that seems dangerous because he has nuclear weapons. But in the past, the leaders of nuclear powers have been pushed out or disposed of. They are leaders in, you know, former Russian leaders. There's a Politburo in China. There is a Central Committee, and there are internal politics. I wonder how much that applies to the current state of Russia, which is more like, you know, the don of a mafia family than the head of the Politburo. What's the mechanism for actually moving against him if other powerful people in Russia deem that he is not acting in their interests?
This question is pointing to kind of the great hope of many people, which is that the best way that this thing could end, given that it doesn't seem like there's a deal that could be offered to Putin himself that he would accept short of regime change, short of annexation, is that somehow he's removed from office, right? Whether it's through some sort of palace coup, something of that nature. And I'm not sure that that can happen. And here's why. There's two reasons I'm not sure this can happen. Reason number one is the nature of these, going back to the sanctions, right? And my understanding of these sanctions is obviously some of them are targeted towards, you know, as people like to call them, the oligarchs, you know, these individuals who very much are part of Putin's inner circle, but they are so reliant on Putin. That's part of their business model, is actually what Putin gives to them, the ability to be able to sell protection from Putin, if you will, that I just don't see them, even under the economic hardship, turning against him. And the other thing is that authoritarian leaders are very good at coup-proofing. Right, especially in situations where they're at war, where, and indeed, sometimes this can even explain why their military doesn't function well. This is a point made by Caitlin Talmadge in her book, Autocracies at War, which is that a lot of times you see authoritarian regimes not do well in fighting because the leaders have taken such steps to ensure that there's nobody in that military who can commit a coup against them. That means sometimes you eliminate the most competent people. So that's another reason why I'm not sure that there's a situation where Putin can be removed from office in the course of this war.
Paul Post is an associate professor at the University of Chicago, a fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Some of his books include Arguing About Alliances, The Art of Agreement in Military Pact Nations, and The Economics of War. You see where that all applies in this situation. Professor Post, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And now the spiel. The headline in the New York Times read, "I've dealt with foreign cyber attacks. America isn't ready for what's coming." I didn't ignore or look away, but there was something about that warning that fell flat with me. I'm sold. America's cyber defenses are vulnerable. America's federal agencies are behind the eight ball. But I guess what failed to move me from words on a page to a feeling or images in my mind is just the nature of cyber attacks. They seem more abstract than immediate. I guess I've never went through one that I felt. There is something distancing about that threat. Let me compare it to other threats. If you ask me in August of 2001, what's the threat of terrorism, this is before 9/11, I can still picture a bombed out barracks, the smoldering husk of a disco, the picture of screaming people, their clothes torn outside an African embassy. Same thing if you said something about aging infrastructure, conjured a bridge collapse, or the threat of not upgrading the energy grid. That to me means a blackout. But how does a cyber attack look? How does it feel? So before I talk to the author of that New York Times op-ed, because I think it's worth getting into, I talked to a friend who is the best cyber reporter I know. She brings stories alive. Dina Temple Raston has been on the show, and she now hosts the Click Here podcast. And Dina warned me that the big cyber attack that we've had so far is the SolarWinds attack, and it really was serious. SolarWinds was a software company, still is, that someone, they think they know who, hacked into. And from there, hackers got to access documents and agency information that use the SolarWinds software, which is to say, most of the agencies in the United States. Dina reported all of this when she was with NPR. Here's some of that. The first voice you will hear talking about what the hackers accessed is Alex Stamos, director of the Internet Observatory at Stanford University. He used to be the head of security at Facebook.
They were able to get access to some very sensitive companies and government organizations without getting caught for quite a while.
And when he says quite a while, he means almost a year. And for all that time, the hackers roamed around the networks of companies like Microsoft, Intel, and Cisco, and government agencies like the Treasury, the Department of Energy, and the Pentagon. And the hackers might have kept skulking around those networks were it not for the vigilance of one company, FireEye, which happened to be one of SolarWinds' customers.
That's right. I mean, we only know about any of this because they made the mistake of attacking FireEye, which is like a professional incident response company.
FireEye led to CrowdStrike, a cyber investigations company. They analyzed the code like a cryptographer would. They tried to catch the culprits going back and updating the code. They thought the hacker was a bear, which is a Russian. If it was a panda, it'd be Chinese. And the North Koreans have their own mythological beast. But they never could quite confirm their suspicion. Adam Myers, who runs intelligence at CrowdStrike, uses this metaphor to try to describe trying to nab the bad guys just in the moment they strike.
right? Like when I was growing up, you used to have to check your Halloween candy because somebody might have put a razor blade in your Reese's peanut butter cup, right? Imagine those Reese's peanut butter cups going into the package, and just before the machine comes down and seals the package, some other thing comes in and slides a razor blade into your Reese's peanut butter cup.
The package gets sealed, and then all these people download it without knowing it's compromised. That worked. That's the scary part. But what does worked mean? What do the infiltrators want? Dina examined the hackers' motivations.
The hackers chose SolarWinds because they thought they would be able to cast a wide net and possibly hack 18,000 customers with just one sophisticated attack. This wasn't just a hack, though. This was really about espionage. The White House thinks Russia was behind this, and specifically that it was a group linked to Russian intelligence, APT-29, known as Cozy Bear. Alex Stamos of Stanford says this was a high-end job. The hackers did their homework. They spent a lot of time studying the adversary.
They demonstrated not just technical acumen, but the way they did this demonstrated that they understand how tech companies operate, how software companies operate.
They showed they knew how to infiltrate. What they didn't exactly show was to what end. For that answer, I consulted with Glenn Gerstel, who was the general counsel of the United States National Security Agency, the NSA, from 2015 to 2020.
Russia is unquestionably capable of using cyber as a weapon that could cause real-world harms, that could cause sluice gates to open on a dam, that could cause electric grids to be turned off, that could cause valves in a water plant to open up or in a chemical plant releasing poisonous gases. So that's all possible. We know the U.S., although we've taken steps recently to get better, we know we're vulnerable in this area. And we know Russia could use cyber to cause real-world problems in the United States, as they have done elsewhere around the world.
It was Gerstel who wrote that Times op-ed. He's the eye in, "I've dealt with foreign cyber attacks. America isn't ready for what's coming." It's a convincing case because Gerstel reminds us, well, not us who just spent some time with Dean in this SolarWinds history, but reminds the public that of course Russia's going to hack us. They already did.
It's sort of like a burglar who came into your home and instead of stealing things, maybe just took pictures of things and maybe left a little something in the window so that he or she could get back in again surreptitiously. So that's going to take a long time to figure out.
For Russia, cyber attacks have become a de rigueur part of war.
We know what these attacks might look like by looking at what Russia has done in the past and what they've done elsewhere. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, the Russia has regarded some of the nearby areas that were formerly part of the Soviet Union, such as Estonia and Latvia, Lithuania in the north, and Ukraine in the south, as their sort of cyber playground, their cyber punching bag. They've tried out their malicious cyber activities in these countries, all sorts of cyber attacks, including in the case of Ukraine, which has been borne the brunt of it, having their electric grid shut down twice, almost completely in 2015 and 2016. And then in 2017, Russia unleashed probably the most malicious cyber bug, cyber virus the world has ever known, the so-called NotPetya bug, which was aimed at some Ukrainian accounting firms, intended to cause havoc in Ukraine for sure, but perhaps recklessly or maliciously or who knows, intentionally, the bug, as computer viruses do, spread elsewhere, quickly going around the world in 2017, causing $10 billion in damage, including here in the U.S. hitting such companies as Federal Express.
Gerstel says Russia has used cyber attacks, will use cyber attacks, will not be deterred from using cyber attacks. Hell, Russia's bombed schools and hospitals. The Ukrainians claim they've killed over 1,000 civilians. They're not going to refrain from fiddling with code. What's more, when the Russians drop a bomb, it's clearly a Russian bomb from a Russian plane. But Gerstel points out that the Russian attacks can simply be executed by Putin essentially winking at cyber criminals in Russia. So what can be done? Well, there are 80 bills before the current Congress addressing some aspect of cybersecurity. Some might not be necessary. Gerstel regards them as collectively insufficient.
They're all individual piecemeal efforts. I mean, they're all well-intentioned. I'm not questioning any of that. But that's not, we could put them all together and we're still not going to be where we need to be.
And where we need to be? Well, we want to live in a world without risk. That's not going to happen. We need to live in a country, Gerstel advocates, with a central warning system or agency that could monitor all the threats and the attacks, and they are constantly happening. We need to be able to communicate warnings, fix damage, and trace attackers back to their roots. You could think of it a little bit like the NSA, but with the go-ahead to investigate domestic hacks, or what the TSA does to investigate and prevent plane crashes. The U.S. has such cybercrime detection and prevention know-how, but does it have the political will to institute the necessary reforms? Gerstel quotes from a government commission recommending better cybersecurity that acknowledges there might need to be a, quote, future emergency to, quote, create the political impetus needed to overcome existing barriers. Gerstel says, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that future is now. And that's it for today's show. Corey War is The Gist's assistant producer. Joel Patterson is The Gist's senior producer. Michelle Pesca is Peachfish Productions' CISO, the chief information security officer. Her first recommendation was that we cancel our subscription to CISO, the NBC comedy streaming service, because it shut down 4 years ago. It represented something of an uncapped gas hose of vulnerability. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, check out advertisecast.com/The Gist. Umpru, depru, dupru, and thanks for listening.